welcome to the Malloy program for this Tuesday evening. Evening, glad you could make it. Gee, only 12 hours, 14 hours left of spring. Time just rips by when you're having fun, huh? I heard on the Weather Channel today that the Midwest had all the tornadoes that should be hitting now. They had them in winter. Oh, God. Climate change. No such thing. Let's strike that from the language. There's no such thing as climate change. There is vociferous big blows hitting and killing folks all over. Something I read today by Joshua Holland, published at Alternet, that I've got to share with you. It's an interview between Josh Holland, he conducted the interview, and M.J. Rosenberg, who is a Middle East analyst. And it was an interview that appeared on Alternet Radio Hour to discuss the Tel Aviv riots.
The what's?
The Tel Aviv riots. You didn't know about that? You didn't know that several weeks ago Israel exploded in a night of right-wing race riots targeting African refugees in Tel Aviv? You didn't know that? Didn't see it on the evening news? Cable channels? According to Josh Holland, the thuggery was frightening. Refugees were attacked. African-owned businesses and stores were vandalized. And a community, the Africans who were there, were forced to hide in fear for their lives. Now, as Holland points out, perhaps more disturbing was that the riots, which began with an anti-immigrant demonstration, sound familiar, were incited by Israeli politicians. Because Israeli politicians are becoming more and more hard right-wing, kind of like here. These politicians got the crowd all excited. They called the refugees infiltrators, cancer. They accused the refugees of violence and rape. A classic example of what is referred to as othering. Othering, you know, the other. Eliminationist rhetoric. Damn, there's a phrase for you, huh? Eliminationist rhetoric that led directly to action by the xenophobic crowd. Josh Holland, you sure does write good, doesn't he? Now, as Holland points out, the riots were carried out by a relatively small number of people, the violence. But they represented the views, apparently, of many Israelis. I'll get to that in a second. A poll released this week found that 52% of the people responding to the poll agreed that the African refugees were a cancer. 52%. And about 33% condoned violence against them. Damn, really? Now, as Holland points out, this story has gotten very little coverage at all in the United States. And were some outlets that did report on the riots advanced the rioters' narrative, that would be the Israelis, that the African refugees were responsible for a wave of street violence, despite the fact that crime stats turn that into a lie. It's just not true. But this is what othering is all about. So recently, Holland interviewed M.J. Rosenberg on the Alternet Radio Hour to discuss the riots. And also to talk about the standoff over Iran's nuclear program and how the Israel lobby demolishes discourse about Israel in the United States. I'm going to share some of that interview with you. Josh starts out, MJ, I want to talk to you about some issues you've been writing about, but first I want to talk a little bit about the discourse here in the United States. I'm one of many people who believe there is an Israel lobby. I'm not sure why that's even controversial. And among other things, it works to kind of narrow the range of acceptable discourse on Israel and Palestine. You're a former AIPAC staffer, right? Rosenberg, right. To defend myself, that was way back in the 80s.
In fact, I was pretty a pretty happy AIPAC staffer. Now, is there anybody out there that doesn't know what AIPAC is? American Israel Political Action Committee. Okay. Rosenberg goes on, I even left there on good terms. I have to say, in those days, it's not so much my politics were different. AIPAC was different. The policies weren't nearly as reactionary then as they are now. Joshua, well, from your inside perspective of that organization, what did you see as far as their tendency to call out criticism that they think is illegitimate or beyond the pale? Rosenberg, well, they consider all criticism of Israel illegitimate. It's all beyond the pale. I suppose their definition would be if, by some miracle, someone like Joe Lieberman made a statement critical of Israel, it would be legitimate. When I worked there in the 80s, back before everyone had computers, they had a big war room where all they did was assemble every bit of data on members of Congress, on candidates, but also on writers, celebrities, anyone in the public eye. They put all this information together. In those days, they would just put all this in these folders. They always had at hand all this negative information, what they considered negative information, to tar people as being anti-Israel or even anti-Semitic. That stuff would be given to reporters if something came up. They were either initiated on their own to give reporters, or some reporter called them because they had a treasure trove of information on people. AIPAC did. They still operate that way. In those days, they did it directly. Now they have former staffers and people who are close to the organization in the blogging world and political world who do it for them. They do it so much. When you read that someone is anti-Israel, they're the ones putting it out there. Joshua, you recently got into a big kerfuffle over your use of the term Israel Firster. The charge comes up again and again. We hear talk about these anti-Semitic tropes, which is something that if you hold up to the light in just the right way and maybe squint your eyes a bit, is vaguely reminiscent of some antiquated anti-Semitic narrative. At the time, I wrote that we live, this is Josh talking, I wrote that we live in a pretty rough and tumble political environment where you can call the president an illegitimate Manchurian candidate, you can call Democrats socialists or Republicans wingnuts, but there isn't really a derogatory term that's acceptable for these advocates of the Israel right. Perhaps that's the best way to put it. I wonder, isn't all this a reaction to this group calling itself pro-Israel? Aren't you pro-Israel? Rosenberg, yeah, I'm pro-Israel. I'm pro-Israel in the sense that I want the country of Israel to live and thrive in security. What they mean by pro-Israel is, do you support all the policies of the government of Israel, except for a peace government like the Rabin government? The reason I coined the phrase Israel Firster is because to me there's no other way to describe it. The same people who call Obama terrible names or Bush terrible names will defend everything Netanyahu says or does. So what is it? Go to the AIPAC convention. They sing the Israeli national anthem. It couldn't be more blatant. They support candidates for office based not on what's good for the United States, but what's good for Israel. AIPAC isn't about caring about Israel, though. It's supporting the occupation, supporting wars in Iran and Iraq, supporting the right wing in Israel. Half the Israeli population, according to polls, are against Netanyahu and are against those policies. AIPAC, here in the United States, and the lobby, which includes other organizations, only support the Israeli right. There's more. Stick around. Get up, stand up.
Life is really worth. It's not all that glitters. not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey, right? With Mike Malloy.
Bull is loading.
You get?
You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has
21 past the hour. Voting, but you. So I'm talking about an interview conducted by Josh Holland with MJ Rosenberg, an Israeli or Middle East expert. And what we're talking about here, this came up last week, or 2 weeks ago, the anniversary, the 46th, 47th anniversary of the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty, a surveillance ship that was operating off the coast of Israel and Egypt during the 67 war. Scores of American sailors were deliberately murdered by the Israeli Air Force, and over 100 were severely wounded. And there's never been an investigation, a real investigation conducted by the U.S. government, any branch of the government, and there never will be. And the question was raised a couple of weeks ago, why? After we did that program about the anniversary of the attack, I received an abundance of emails asking me, as if I were to know, why an investigation had never been conducted. Well, the quick answer is because Israel has such a deathlock on U.S. politicians, way out of proportion to the influence that Jewish Americans should have on American politicians. But it does happen. It is happening. So sitting as we are sitting on the brink of constantly brink of war in the Middle East, whether it is Iraq or Syria or Egypt or Libya or Iran, and knowing that the Israeli right-wingers, not the Israeli people, the Israeli right-wing government of Netanyahu and this whole Likud party have the power to drag the United States into another bloody war. Why? Well, that's what we're talking about. Josh Holland is interviewing MJ Rosenberg. Holland said, I want to talk about an issue that came up recently that's gotten very little coverage in the United States. There were a series of violent race riots by right-wing Israelis against African immigrants in Tel Aviv. This was a big deal. I was looking at the U.S. coverage, and it was amazing at how little attention these riots received. The Christian Science Monitor ran a piece. The New York Times wrote about it on its blog, and some papers actually took the side of the rioters. That would be the Israelis. In a sense, framing the issue as related to, quote, African violence, which is a pretty dubious claim as far as I can see. Tell us about what happened and what it says about Israeli society today. Now, there's a note here. Several days after this interview was conducted, the New York Times did run an article on the violence in Tel Aviv. MJ Rosenberg, quote, Israeli society in general is becoming increasingly paranoid about everything, which is strange because Israel as a country is militarily more powerful and its people are more secure than probably ever before. There's not terrorism or anything like that anymore, thank goodness. Yet there's this real string of paranoia stirred up by Netanyahu. He's always talking about the Holocaust. He says this is just like 1942, which was probably the worst year in Jewish history. He's always invoking those kind of tropes, and it's causing a lot of xenophobia. They're afraid of foreigners. You know, the whole world is against us, is something they still say. Now, you have these refugees from Africa who have made their way to Israel through the Sinai. These are mostly Sudanese. They're black people, and they are what the right here calls illegals. What they actually are is refugees, which is something Jews should be able to relate to. They move for the most part into Tel Aviv, where there's work for them. All of a sudden, the word has gotten out that these people are responsible for crime. Statistically, it's been proven that's not true. There's crime in Tel Aviv, very low by our standards, but the crime is not associated with Africans. But it led to this kind of rage, almost reminiscent of the 1940s or 1950s here in the South. It's when they started grabbing black people in the streets and just beating them up. Then, and here's something that hasn't happened much here in probably 100 years here in the United States, politicians, right-wing politicians from both the Likud and Kadima parties, which are the two biggest parties, started denouncing the Africans and the Sudanese. They said they're a danger to Israel and called for rallies in South Tel Aviv, where they are. You have mobs of right-wingers who look sort of like soccer mobs, the mobs that you see in Europe after a soccer game, where they go marching in with lots of young thugs and start grabbing people on the street. They're chanting, "Go back to Africa!" and "Death to the Africans!" People are really upset by this. I don't want to in any way imply that most Israelis are happy about this. Many Israelis are appalled. It's the biggest story in the country right now, and you will only be able to read about it if you read the Israeli press. This is a common thing when there are bad things going on inside Israel, the way they treat the Palestinians, and in this case, the way they're treating these poor African refugees from loathsome regimes who wind up in Israel. These stories are, well, I don't want to say suppressed in the United States, but it's striking how much coverage they get in Israel and how a paper like the New York Times is too scared to touch it. More when we come back.
Let Mike do it for you. It's Mike Malloy.
I was born like this.
25 before the hour. By the way, at the top of the next hour, we're going to be joined by Bob Kincaid, the king of all internet radio, who has been busy in Washington, D.C., and got a piece of legislation introduced today. We're going to be talking to Bob Kincaid about that a little bit later tonight. All right, stick around. Back to this interview. In Alternet, Joshua Holland is an editor and senior writer at Alternet. He is the author of the 15 biggest lies about the economy and everything else the right wing doesn't want you to know about. Excuse me, taxes, jobs, and corporate America. And M.J. Rosenberg, who is a Middle East expert or analyst. And this interview appeared on the Alternet Radio Hour in order to talk about the Tel Aviv riots, the standoff over Iran's nuclear program, and how the Israeli lobby controls public discourse in this country where it concerns Israel. we're back to the interview. Rosenberg is explaining why so many topics are not touched, that they have a direct effect on the United States or a negative effect on Israel, are not touched by the American media. Rosenberg says, "I have to say they're referring to American media, they're afraid to touch it. The reason is when an American outlet talks about Israel in any way that's negative or reports on anything negative about Israel, they will be inundated with complaints from powerful people who will tell them, 'Why are you picking on Israel?' They always say, 'Why is it that China's doing these things? You're not writing about that.' Of course they do. You even see it in the blogosphere, too, the intimidation. If you are utterly secure in your position in the media, then you don't mess with Israel. More to the point, you don't mess with the people here who are Israel's enforcers. It's a strange deal. One of the reasons there is so much more free discourse in Israel is that they don't have an Israeli lobby over there. There's no AIPAC. I mean, there's an AIPAC there to work with American members of Congress who come over there, but they don't try to enforce orthodoxy among Israeli politicians. If the newspaper Haaretz tried to open up a branch here in the United States, AIPAC would shut it down. Just look at the so-called liberal cable network MSNBC and how little coverage they give to the Middle East." Joshua, it really is remarkable how this story has almost disappeared. "I should point out that the Israeli lobby is not a Jewish lobby. It includes very powerful Christian evangelical groups, Citizens United for Israel, for example. Most American Jews tend to skew leftward a bit and are obviously an influential group in Democratic politics. But on the Republican side, you have these very influential groups associated with the Christian right who are just as big of a part of the Israel lobby as AIPAC. I just want to make that clear. Now, I want to turn to Iran for a minute. Earlier in the show, we were talking about how disastrous a military strike on Iran would be. The military sees it that way. The military and intelligence community's views on that are very much at odds with conservative politicians. To put it simply, there would be no Iran hysteria were it not for the Israel lobby. You wrote that. MJ, are you suggesting that domestic lobbying groups are actively trying to kill a deal? They've been negotiating some sort of settlement to the standoff in Baghdad. You're suggesting that they're trying to kill a deal that might actually ease tensions over Iran's nuclear program? Rosenberg, AIPAC is getting its cues from Prime Minister Netanyahu, who either wants a war or wants to maintain the illusion that he wants a war. It's hard to imagine what he wants. That's the message he gives AIPAC, which is pushing more sanctions. At the same time, the Iranians seem to be willing to make a deal. They came out clearly at the beginning of these negotiations. What was our response when it seemed like the Iranians were ready to make an offer? We immediately said, Hillary Clinton and other people in the administration said, we will not consider lifting any sanctions. How do you negotiate with people when you're telling them that no matter what they do, you're going to continue the sanctions? The sanctions are sponsored by AIPAC. The sanctions are written in their offices, then delivered to members of Congress and passed by Congress. There are even new ones going into effect next month in July. So no matter what the Iranians do, we're going to keep the sanctions on, which is causing Iranians to suffer. Joshua, just so folks understand, Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which guarantees signatories the right to refine uranium for non-military purposes. By saying that they won't be accepting any enrichment whatsoever, that is, by rejecting the idea that Iranians can enrich for non-military purposes, they, the Israelis and the Americans, are basically killing the deal. Because one thing Iranians agree on is that they have a right to enrich for purposes other than making weapons. Rosenberg. Yes, and I'd like to make the point that Israel is not a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And they have 200 nuclear weapons. And that won't show up in the news stories either. It's pretty amazing. Now, you can hear the whole interview if you want to by going to alternate.org. And look for this interview conducted by Joshua Holland with MJ Rosenberg. And the reason it is important is because the Christian right in this country, and you know who I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the nuns who are on the bus tour trying to do what they feel that their Redeemer told them to do. I'm not talking about the Lutheran, the Susquehanna Lutheran Synod that has come out against this horror of fracking, destroying the environment, destroying people's lives and their livelihoods so that these mega energy corporations can make billions more. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about these crazed, sick, destructive evangelical Christians who are hell-bent on blowing the world up because they have this sick, truly, truly, clinically insane view that their mystery man will appear as long as there's enough death and destruction. And the Israelis play these fools for the fools that they are. Because the Israelis know as long as they have this Christian right group on the hook, they can get anything they want from the U.S. Congress. Anything. And not a single member of Congress, whether they're Jewish or not Jewish, will stand up against these people. Not one. With the possible exception, perhaps, and I don't even know about this, but Ron Paul. But nobody else will. Maybe Bernie Sanders. Every single member of Congress, all your so-called liberals, and certainly these mouth-breathing, psychopathic conservatives will do exactly what they're told to do where it concerns Israel, whether it hurts the United States or not. Now, let me ask you something. Do you think our policies regarding Israel over the past two-thirds of a century have hurt or helped the U.S. and the Middle East? 3, 2, 1. Really? So why do we continue? Because these cowardly Republicans and Democrats know that if they take a stand against Israel policies, the right-wing Israeli policies, then they will be targeted. American members of Congress will be targeted for defeat. Anybody in media who stands up to these bastards will be targeted for defeat, or to have their programs canceled, or their advertisers flee. We know how this works. So, when the next anniversary of the attack on the USS Liberty rolls around next June, May, the next time it rolls around, there's no reason to sit around and question why American media don't talk about it. There's no reason to sit around and wonder why all the liberals on MSNBC don't bring it up. There's no reason to question why editorial writers and opinion makers don't say, hey, wait a minute. It's 47 years ago. Why did that occur? Now, I'm sure most of the people listening to this program are familiar with AIPAC because we've talked about it time and time again. It churns my stomach to think that we have 535 members of the House and the Senate who dare not peep, not a goddamn peep, about Israel policies in the Middle East, whether it affects us to the point of pulling our people into an active war or not. It doesn't matter. None of these cowards in the American Congress will say no when no has to be said. And every single time a resolution is introduced in the United Nations condemning an act of country A, it's passed. Country B, it's passed. C, D, passed. E, F, G, H, passed. Israel, no, defeated. Because the U.S. in the Security Council says no. Anybody else? Condemnation. Anybody else? Sanctions. Anybody else charged with human rights abuses? But when it comes to Israel, when it comes to Palestine, the United States, every single time, will veto any attempt to hold Israel responsible for its actions. And there's not a single member of Congress who will take a stand. And you can count the people and media in this country on the fingers of one hand who will take a stand.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich. That's how it goes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling.
And watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. Okay, so now we can start with the you're an anti-Semite. Emails. I always enjoy those. I really do. got a mini moment. Do we have the music handy? This is a mini moment with Bob. We don't need the music for a mini moment, I don't think. Unless you have it. Do you have the moment with Bob music? Kathy hates it when I do things like that. Just pop up out of the weeds and say, "Hey, have you got the moment with Bob music?" I get the look through the glass. Like, you think the Israeli lobby is going to give you hell? Well, the show's over. Another moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. Hey, Mike! Tough guy writer James Ellroy's 1995 novel, American Tabloid, starts off with this. America was never innocent. We popped our cherry on the boat over and looked back with no regrets. You can't ascribe our fall from grace to any single event or set of circumstances. You can't lose what you lacked at conception. Mass marketing nostalgia gets you hopped up for a past that never existed. Hagiography sanctifies shuck and jive politicians and reinvents their expedient gestures as moments of great moral weight. Our continuing narrative line is a blurred past truth and hindsight. Only a reckless verisimilitude can set that line straight. The real trinity of Camelot was look good, kick ass, get laid. Jack Kennedy was the mythological front man for a particularly juicy slice of our history. He talked a slick line and wore a world-class haircut. He was Bill Clinton minus pervasive media scrutiny and a few rolls of flab. End quote. Well, Bob continues, our current well-spoken president has a list of people he wants to kill with those fabulous drones of his. Hitler set off 9,521 V-1 rockets toward England and killed 22,892 people. George Bush and Barack Obama, between them, authorized 326 drone attacks and killed 2,832 people. Sure, the Nazis had volume, but let's talk civilian kill ratios. American technology is four times better when it comes to bringing down hellfire. Someday this fall, I'll receive my absentee ballot in the mail. If I vote for Democrats, I'll be supporting the president, senators, and congressmen who passed on holding the Bush-Cheney regime accountable, who passed on holding Wall Street accountable, but passed and signed laws like the National Defense Authorization Act. If I vote Republican, I'll get an administration very similar to the one we've endured since the advent of hope and change. The elite's war on poor people, the middle class, and especially women will get uglier, more overt, if that's possible. Maybe that's what's needed to make people finally shove back and say enough. The most positive thing I can do with my vote is to recycle it. It's worth the paper it's printed on. Our democratic republic isn't just broken, it's smashed into a fine powder. If the handle of your favorite coffee mug snaps off, you can crazy glue it back on and use it tomorrow. But you can't crazy glue powder together and end up with anything that looked and functioned like your old coffee mug. Best sweep it up and throw it away. Besides, the political game is a diversion anyway. It's just one part of the dominant culture's noise machine. Kurt Vonnegut's 2005 collection of essays, Man Without a Country, sums it up. Quote, we are killing this planet as a life support system with the poisons from all the thermodynamic whoopee we're making with atomic energy and fossil fuels, and everybody knows it, and practically nobody cares. This is how crazy we are. We're really awful animals. I mean, that dumb Barbara Streisand song, people who need people are the luckiest people in the world. She's talking about cannibals. Lots to eat. Yes, the planet is trying to get rid of us. But I think it's too late. The good Earth, we could have saved it. But we were too damn cheap and lazy. End quote. Kurt Vonnegut. Regards, Bob. Another mini moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. Speaking of Bob's, Bob Kincaid is going to join us after the break here at the top of the hour. I did not know this. Perhaps you did. But Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat of Ohio, who is in his last moments, and Louise Slaughter, a Democrat of New York, joined congressional reps from across the country today and introduced H.R. 5959. It's the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. The acronym is ACHE, A-C-H-E, Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. The bill places, quote, a moratorium on permitting for mountaintop removal coal mining until health studies are conducted by the Department of Health and Human Services, end quote. And according to Dennis Kucinich, quote, the ACHE Act will stop new mountaintop removal coal mines until the science clearly demonstrates that mines will not cost these hardworking communities their health or their lives. It will also fund some of the best researchers in the world to carry out that science, end quote, Dennis Kucinich. Well, how do you think this is going to be received by a right wing? I'm talking about Democrats as well as Republicans, by a right wing House of Representatives. How do you think it's going to be received? We'll find out. We'll go right to the source and talk to Bob Kincaid, who is the board president of the Coal River Mountain Watch, coming up right after the break. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. Of Representatives, two members of Congress, Dennis Kucinich, Democrat of Ohio, Louise Slaughter, Democrat of New York, joined with some other members of Congress to introduce what is referred to as House Resolution 5959, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. First four letters form the acronym ACHE, A-C-H-E, Act. The bill places what is described as, quote, a moratorium on permitting for mountaintop removal coal mining until health studies are conducted by the Department of Health and Human Services. What has prompted this is over the past 20 years, maybe not 20 years, the past decade, though, coal mining residents, people who live in these areas, have pleaded for basic civil rights and environmental protection. More than 20 peer-reviewed studies have suggested higher risks and links between strip mining and devastating health impacts, including birth defects, cancer, chronic heart, lung, and kidney disease. And a report released last week noted that strip miners are even subjected to unacceptable levels of black lung disease. I didn't realize there was an acceptable level, but whatever. If you go to ecowatch.org, there's an article there by Jeff Biggers, ecowatch.org, that'll fill you in on some of the details. But going to the source, as we are wont to do, we're joined now by Bob Kincaid. Bob is board president of the Coal River Mountain Watch. He also is with the Appalachian Health Emergency Community. And if you are familiar with his radio program, he has one of the more ass-kicking radio programs on the net, headonradionetwork.org. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Mike.
And he also is one of the people who gets me out of jail. Who gets you out of jail?
Thus far, I've just been the wheel man, and I haven't caught up with you.
Oh, well, good for you. Good for you. All right, what happened today?
Today was the culmination of a long slog, as it were, to try to get Congress to pay attention to the health crisis that is emerging and has been emerging in Appalachia. A little band of us have been working since late February on an idea that took shape almost 2 years ago to quit shilly-shallying about and actually demand that this be stopped. And what this is, of course, mountaintop removal, a process by which in excess of 150 billion, with a B, pounds of high explosives, the same kind of high explosives that Timothy McVeigh used on the Murrah Federal Building, are used in Appalachia every year. That works out to about 5 million pounds a day, and that works out to about 714 Timothy McVeigh bombs per day in Appalachia.
Jesus.
And when they blow this stuff up, it puts all kinds of poisons into the air and into the water. It lands on the soil. It lands on our homes. It lands in our lungs. And there's not a blessed thing you can do about it. If you live in Appalachia near a mountaintop removal site, the science says you've got worse than average chances of being the host of some pretty god awful diseases, as well as what happens to babies in the womb. Birth defects, cancers, heart diseases, all the things you mentioned. It is literally a scourge and a plague on this region that has suffered for so long in the first place.
Why do the members of the congressional delegation from West Virginia and the senators and the governor, why did they seem to support the coal industry? Go ahead, knock it out of the park.
Well, they have the common decency. They're bought and they stay bought.
Boom!
We don't so much have a two-party system in West Virginia, Mike. We have colocrats and colicans.
Colocrats and colicans. I would imagine that applies to Kentucky and Ohio and Pennsylvania and North Georgia and Northeast Alabama, too.
Absolutely. The coal industry has had its tentacles in the coal fields of Appalachia for over 100 years, and they don't show any sign of letting go unless they decide that they're going to let go when they've taken every last bit of wealth out of the ground and left us high and dry and dying.
I've seen some videos where you are addressing a crowd of people, and I've seen your fist up in the air, and I've seen your face get red. And at those rallies, what are you advocating for? What are you screaming about?
Basic human rights.
Ah. Those again.
Well, yeah, you know, we talk about this in environmental terms, but the fact of the matter is I have yet to run into an environmental issue that isn't a human rights issue. It's kind of like that old business of if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there, does it make a sound? If you can't live somewhere, if the portion of the planet you happen to be on that makes you die prematurely, and 3,975 West Virginians do every year as a direct and proximate result of mountaintop removal, well, then you've transcended environmentalism and you've gone into the realm of civil and human rights.
Mm-hmm. This whole idea, explain, if you would, you gave us a pretty vivid picture of the explosive power being used in West Virginia. But give us a picture of what mountaintop removal really is. First time I ever heard of it, I thought, well, they blow off the top of the mountain. But that can't be, can it?
No, because the Appalachians are the oldest mountains on the planet.
Right.
Once upon a time, they were bigger than the Himalayas. And over time, they've been worn down to these lush green hills. The Appalachians are, in fact, a temperate rainforest, and they've got lots of hollers and little streams in them. And when they say mountaintop removal, oh, well, okay, you know, we'll take the 30 feet. No, we're talking about 800, as much as 800 feet to get to multiple layers of coal seams, they're called, that are sometimes as little as 6 or 10 inches thick. And what they do is they skin the mountain. They cut down all the trees and usually burn them, or else they just shove them over into the next valley and bury some of those streams I mentioned. Over the course of the years, something around 2,000 miles of streams have been buried. And those are the headwater streams for the water you and Kathy and Molly drink, because it feeds the entire Southeast. So the streams get buried, and then they take, and then they start doing the blasting with the explosives I mentioned. And what they loosen up over top of the coal seams, they then shove over into the valley, and they fill the valley in. So yeah, 2,000 miles of streams, over 500 of the oldest mountains on Earth have been destroyed. And when you destroy those mountains, you of necessity destroy the communities that live near them. The numbers are stunning. For instance, a woman who is pregnant, who lives near a mountaintop removal site but doesn't smoke, has 180+% greater chance of giving birth to a baby with respiratory birth defects than does a pregnant mother who smokes but doesn't live near mountaintop removal.
Good God. You would think that the right-wingers could be appealed to on that basis, since they seem like they'll do anything to preserve the life of a fetus.
Well, we kind of plan on confronting them with it. But it was a heroic effort just getting the bill out. We've got 14 real heroes in the House of Representatives, and we found out who they are. And of course, Mike, I'm sure it comes as no surprise to you to find out that the greatest hero of them all is Dennis Kucinich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No.
Dennis looked at us and said, "How can I help?" And beginning with him, he then joined with Representative Louise Slaughter from New York, who is from Harlan County, Kentucky. I'm sure you've heard that old song, You'll Never Leave Harlan Alive.
Right.
Well, she did. But she is still Appalachian at heart, and she heard about this and said, "How can I help?" And then we were joined by a real hero from Kentucky, John Yarmuth, who represents a district in Louisville. He got on board. Maurice Hinchy from New York got on board.
Hey, Bob, hold it right there. I got to do some commercials. We'll be right back, and we'll finish up. I want to hear the rest of the names on that list. Hold on a second. Wait.
Sure.
Okay. We're talking with Bob Kincaid. The AIC Act was introduced in the U.S. House today. That's what we're talking about. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
And as patient and white as a February snow, for I was born and raised at the mouth of the Hazard Hollow. Coal cars roaring and rumbling past my door. Now they're standing a rusty roll empty, and the yelling didn't stop here anymore. Well, last night I dreamed I went down to the office to get my pay like I'd done.
The hour. We're talking with Bob Kincaid, who, along with other anti-strip mining or mountaintop removal mining activists, worked together with 14 or 15 members of Congress to get introduced in that august body the what is referred to as the AIC Act, the ACHE, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, which would place a moratorium on permitting for mountaintop removal until health studies are conducted by the Department of Health and Human Services. Now, you mentioned Kucinich and Slaughter, and I left out Virginia and New York, parts of those two states as being parts of Appalachia also. And a lot of people don't think of New York as being part of Appalachia or even Alabama, but that whole mountain range runs from New York all the way to Alabama, right?
It absolutely does. Actually, it runs from up across the border into Canada.
Oh, really?
All the way to the very northeastern corner of Mississippi.
Good Lord, that's a pretty long mountain range. Now, you were talking about the people who introduce us, the members of Congress, and if you'd continue, because I like people to hear their names.
Well, Ed, I'm not sure if I can remember them all off the bat, but we have, of course, Kucinich and Slaughter. We have Mike Honda from California. We have Judy Chu from California. We have Earl Blumenauer from Oregon. We have John Yarmuth from Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Maurice Hinchy from New York. Keith Ellison from Minnesota. I have to give a little plug here. You know my son Ferg, Mike.
Oh yeah.
We were hanging out outside the Capitol building when they went into session last night, and as they came out, Ferg said, "There goes Keith Ellison," and chased him down and told him about the AIC Act, and said, "We really, really need you to stand up for oppressed people in Appalachia," and we got the word this morning that he had signed on.
Ferg cracks me up. I've never met a young man like your son who is, A, won't take no for an answer, B, is just an absolute devoted activist where it concerns these human rights issues. I've spent a bit of time with Ferg. The latest was during the presentation of the arguments before the Supreme Court regarding the Affordable Care Act, and of course you were there too, but hanging out with Ferg and with Tara Devlin was quite an experience. You talk about the three musketeers. The three of us had a great time working the crowd, I'm telling you. Let me ask you something. I got a question. Somebody wanted me to ask you about radioactivity concerning mountaintop removal.
Sure. There's the coal is by its very nature radioactive. Every nasty thing under the sun is in a coal seam, because after all, it's the way that the Earth sequestered its filth millions and millions and millions of years ago.
Mm.
So there's radioactivity. Practically the entire heavy metals side of the periodic table of the elements is in there: selenium, cadmium, barium, mercury, arsenic. There's nothing good about it, and of course, those are all the things that are being pumped into human beings when the blasting takes place, and when they bury our streams, and when they build these giant. Most people don't know, Mike, that the largest dam in the Western Hemisphere is not outside Las Vegas. It's outside Beckley, West Virginia, and it holds back 9.8 billion gallons of toxic waste behind an earth, the dirt dam.
Yeah, I've read about that. What happens when that finally lets go?
Everybody dies.
Everybody. Yeah.
It's going to send a wall of toxic goo somewhere between 40 and 100 feet high down a very narrow river valley where there isn't anything 40 to 100 feet high. So for about 100 miles.
Good God.
I can't overemphasize what a heroic thing these 14 members of Congress have done. Never in the history of that, as you noted, august body, Mike, has anyone ever stood up and looked at the coal industry and simply said no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that happened today. And, you know, the next step is to get other people on board. So folks can learn all about it by going to StopTheAIC, just like it sounds, .org. And you can ask your own member of Congress to sign on, and if they say no, ask them why not. Because mountaintop removal does nothing for America. It's less than 1.4% of our overall coal production, and it doesn't even necessarily go into electricity. The mountain near where I live, for instance, is being shipped ton by ton to India.
Hey, can you hold on again, Bob? Do you have to go?
No.
Okay. Because I know you're heading for Alabama soon. Let me put you on hold. We'll do another break, and I just want you to talk about this a little bit more, okay?
Okay.
All right. We're talking to Bob Kincaid. And by the way, you can hear him every night on headonradionetwork.org on your electric computer. He does a program. Huh? Right after this show? Or does he stream before? Yeah, I'll ask him. It's either right before or right after this program. I should know that. Right after this program, I go to bed. I think it's right before this program. We'll ask him when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. 5 before the hour. We're talking to Bob Kincaid, who, among other things, has been very active in getting the ACHE, the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act, before Congress, which it now is as of today. I just don't know where to start. On this particular issue, I know you have been literally, not academically, you have literally been living this as long as you and your family have been in West Virginia. What about arsenic in the water? What about these heavy metals that show up? Is that what these studies are going to be about?
It's hard to say, but we anticipate it kind of can't help but be that, Mike, because that's what's there. That's what they're putting into us. There are parents who bathe their children in water that is from their wells that should be clear and beautiful and fresh and wonderful, but instead are turned orange and are loaded with arsenic. And as a consequence, that stuff's not good for you. It's really, really bad for you. And things like that, selenium, cadmium, barium, manganese, aluminum, it all comes off of these sites. And it all winds up in somebody's beloved child or grandfather or grandmother.
You know, I have to ask an inflammatory and stupid question. If they're killing us, why can't we kill them?
The only good answer, rational answer I have to that, Mike, is that that's what they'd really kind of like for us to try that. But I know that every time we do, they have no compunction against gunning us down in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, I'm committed to Gandhi's way and Dr. King's way, peaceful, nonviolent action, not pacifism by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But by taking that opportunity away from them. We've seen in West Virginia, for instance, back in 1921, what happens when they take up arms. You know, after the Civil War, the single largest land battle in the United States was the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921. Mm-hmm. And that's when the miners took up arms, and the federal government, the coal companies, the state militia, all landed on them like a duck on a June bug.
Mm-hmm.
And set back labor rights until FDR came along and signed the National Labor Relations Act into law.
Would the appearance of a John L. Lewis type figure make any difference?
It breaks my heart to say this, Mike, and it does not come easily, because my father, my grandfather, and my great-grandfather were all Union coal miners. The UMWA is one of the biggest parts of the mountaintop removal problem because they support it.
Oh, my God. Okay. See, that's what I mean about not understanding this issue unless you are actually living it like you have done. I had no idea. The unions support it from the standpoint of employment?
Yeah, they've got, I guess, the UMWA in West Virginia has about 1,000 people working on mountaintop removal sites. Now, remember, every one of those 1,000 UMWA miners is going to let some random West Virginian die for them this year. Mm-hmm. In what science refers to as excess death. Maybe I know them, maybe I don't, but they're going to die this year directly as a result of mountaintop removal.
Why mountaintop removal at all? Is the only answer to that because it is cheaper for the coal companies to do that? Is that the only answer?
It's not only cheaper, it's profitable to the so-called fat cats, big wigs, whatever. It's great for Wall Streeters. It's great for coal company executives. And it's dirty. It takes very little actual employment. Around 1980 in West Virginia, I think there were 100,000 coal miners. The mountaintop removal is done in West Virginia now with less than 4,000.
Good God.
It's all machines. And so, you know, a gang of about 15 can take down 5,000 acres maybe in 5 or 10 years. And when I say take down, I mean and leave it a moonscape, you know, the kind of place mm-hmm. that a buzzard couldn't find lunch. It's awful. Less than 3% of all the mountaintop removal sites in the country, in Appalachia, have ever been reclaimed within the meaning of the law.
How, you know, I sometimes, I'm sure you do too, I know you do, just get so sick of this. This being issues like this particular issue, especially the ones that deprive or deny people of human rights, which includes the right to clean water, clean air, decent ground to plant things in. How much more of this? I mean, how much longer can this go on, including mountaintop removal, but the fracking now and the tar sands and the burning of this filth, you know, the fact that it goes to India and is used in furnaces there really doesn't mean a damn thing as far as global climate change. It might as well be burned in Wheeling. So how much more of this can go on?
The planet can't take much more.
Well, that's what I'm thinking.
And the best slogan I've seen in a long time, Mike, is there is no planet B.
Yeah.
Not, no plan B, no planet B.
No planet B.
And as badly as I would like to send the Rand Pauls and the Mitch McConnells and the George Bushes to Mars, we just haven't figured out a way yet. So we can't take much more. We know what's going to happen if the tar sands are expanded. We know what the coal industry has planned for the west coast of the United States. Massive coal terminals, 1,000-mile-long railroad lines that will carry poisonous coal from the open pit cesspits of Wyoming to Puget Sound, which I've never seen, but I know you have, and I know it's beautiful, and I know we both have friends there. The American people have a vested interest, especially people of goodwill, progressives, liberals, whatever we care to call ourselves, have a vested interest in getting behind this bill now, because stopping mountaintop removal is going to be a very, very hard job, but if we can stop it in Appalachia, we can stop it anywhere.
The website people need to go to is Stop the Ache, just like it sounds, stoptheache.org. You'll find information. It is H.R. 5959 if you want to write your member of Congress, which brings me to the next question. What are the chances, Bob, of something like this actually being funded in the U.S. Congress, given the fact that it is, with the exception of the people you named, it is a right-wing Congress? I don't care if it's Democrat or Republican, doesn't matter anymore. It's a right-wing Congress. You know, you can get 150 or 200 members of Congress to sign on to a bill to deprive a woman of her right to privacy when she goes to her doctor. You got 15, 16, 17 people to sign on to this, and maybe more will, but I'm just using it as an example. What are the chances of this bill even getting to the floor, much less a vote being taken on it?
I don't know exactly what those chances are. All I know is we have to try.
Well, I hear that, and I appreciate that statement. But I can't.
I mean, this Congress is waning now, so it may very well have to be reintroduced in January. Mm-hmm. I'd like to hope there will be enough of a change to give it a better chance then. But it's not just a Republican problem. My own member of Congress does things like jump out of planes to prove his loyalty to the coal industry, Mike, and he's a Democrat, okay?
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's why I said Democrat, Republican. You know and I know it doesn't matter where the dam anymore, Bob.
But the thing is, Mike, and this is where I take my inspiration, there is a long history in the United States of members of government from other corners of the country standing up, refusing to be silent, and saying it is not okay to do this to these people. Mm-hmm. And that's whether it's John Quincy Adams in Massachusetts writing an objection to the so-called gag rule about talking about slavery in the mid-19th century in the House, or whether it's the brave and bold people who stood up and said that the civil rights abuses of the Deep South were no longer acceptable, while Senator Cornpone and Congressman the Possum said, oh, it's a way of life. We do have a history of waking up and saying no, and that's what we're banking on here.
By the way, Congressman Possum was from Georgia.
No, absolutely. And Senator Cornpone was from Alabama, Stan. No doubt about it.
Oh, my God. I want to clear something up. Bob Kincaid's program is on from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You go to headonradionetwork.org and you'll hear some kind of radio that, you're not going to hear on the radio, if that makes any sense.
Technically it's .com, Mike, but yeah.
Oh, it's .com?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just .com, .org gets me confused. Now, tomorrow or Friday and Saturday, you're going to be in Alabama. Let me just do a break. One more. Can you stick around one more minute?
Oh, sure.
Okay, let me put you on hold, because Bob and his family are, packing up the campsite and heading south from D.C. tomorrow, and I want him to tell you why. All right? Stick around. Quick break here. We'll be back talking with Bob Kincaid about StopTheAche.org. StopTheAche.org. Please go to that website.
Crystal fountains, so come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land.
10 before the hour, a couple of items over at tvnewslies.org. The lead article is about the bill that Bob Kincaid has been talking about. There's also a link there to the AIC homepage. But you can get there by going to StopTheAche.org. Either way, check out what TVNewsLies.org has up. Also, Tim in L.A. just sent me a link, Bob, to an article in Scientific American from December 13, 2007. Coal ash is more radioactive than nuclear waste.
Not at all surprising.
Who'd have thunk it? I mean, you know, from Scientific American. And the article, it goes on about why it is and the danger. And then also our friend Jude, in Seattle sent me a link to West Virginia's most massive coal waste impoundment, you know, Brushy Fork. And there are some photographs here and some information. It reads like something you may have written, but, it's at the, Organized Voices and empowered communities, and this is just scary. I mean, especially when you see these photos, and these photos were taken, I think, in 2003. But as you said, 8 billion gallons of coal waste sludge when this thing is finished filling, the dam will be 954 feet high. And the failure of this thing is going to be a disaster for everybody south of West Virginia. Not only that, but as this article says, Brushy Fork is a tributary of Little Marsh Fork, which flows into Marsh Fork, comprising part of the headwaters of the Coal River upstream of the town Whitesville. The Coal River flows into the Kanawha River, which flows into the Ohio River, which flows into the Mississippi, which flows into the Gulf, which mingles with the ocean's waters, which is all part of the planet's hydrologic cycle, which means we all live downstream from this. I mean, this is stuff to make your stomach churn.
It's nightmare-inducing, Mike.
It really is. And nobody knows about this. You know, I consider myself fairly well informed. I didn't know about any of this until I started talking with you a couple of years ago.
And that's the biggest problem. This has been the coal industry's filthy little secret for years and years and years. And that's part and parcel of what we're doing here is we're trying to break the silence. We're trying to take that secret away from them. And this is the kick. If you can do this to Appalachian people, as we're finding out with the tar sands, as we're finding out with fracking, all these, you can do it to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that creates the urgency for ending it.
Well, the bill that we've been talking about is H.R. 5959. You need to check this out, Truth Seeker, if for no other reason, just to find out what the hell's going on, because this is a topic you don't know about.
And it's something we can fight back on.
And that's true. You can go to the website, stoptheache.org, and you can listen to Bob's internet program every night, 6 to 9 Eastern Time, at headonradionetwork.com. Right? .com.
.com. Exactly.
Now,
but I'm a whole bunch of reruns right now, which sadly
Well, that's all right. It's still good stuff. Now, you're heading, and I guess Ferg's going with you. Are the girls going with you and your wife?
One of two of them is. Two of the girls, one of them's been rather ill, and so the youngest, Doodle, whom you know, mm-hmm. is staying with her right now. But Margie and Ferg and my wife and I are heading out of here tomorrow and taking off for
Selma, Alabama.
Yes, indeed.
You're going to walk that walk across the Pettus Bridge, I understand.
Yes, I am. Apparently, I've been invited to a march there because, well, you know well what a bit of manifest lunacy Alabama's immigration law is.
Right. Oh my God.
And what it's done to people there. So this is in support of immigrant rights. In Alabama, mm-hmm. and it's an honor to be able to take that walk.
You're going to be surrounded by a lot of history, as you know, and it's right and appropriate and fitting that people like John Lewis and Dr. Kang and Hosea Williams and Andy Young and all those people who marched in Selma for one form of human rights all those years ago, and now another form of human rights. Of course, they're all the same, but I mean in different manifestations, and you'll be included in that march. I wish you the best. This is another thing that how many people know about? I mean, I did not know about this until our mutual friend Jude in Seattle sent me the email, forwarded to me the email that you wrote to her earlier today, and there it is. And, you know, who knows about this? I mean, where's the New York Times? Where's the Washington Post? Where's MSNBC?
They're just trying to figure out how to stay alive, I guess, at this point. The for-profit media is... We'd like for it to be more than it is. We'd like for it to fulfill its constitutionally mentioned mm-hmm. mandate.
Mm-hmm.
But the same profiteers have hold of it that have hold of the rest of the economy. It's all one percenters, Mike.
Well, good luck tomorrow, Friday and Saturday, and bless your heart for everything that you do. I don't think, I don't know if your listeners understand how active you are. And the things that you have done and the things you continue to do. And I have a deep and abiding respect for you and Ferg and your wife and the girls. And just take care of yourselves, okay?
Thank you, Mike. It's a two-way street.
All right, sir. We'll talk soon.
All right.
All right. Take care, Bob. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. 7 past the hour. StopTheAche, ache.org. Please go to that website. And also, like Bob said, they're running some rebroadcasts here because he is on the road trying to make things a little bit better for all of us. But listen to his program. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. We have some open phone lines here if you'd like to call in. 877-99-MALLOY. Or 877-996-2556. Got an email from Patrick, who writes, he's a new listener. He writes, "Hi, Mike. I've enjoyed listening to your show at night while driving home from work to L.A. from Anaheim. I'm originally from North Carolina. I like that you don't hold back punches toward either party, or what's left of them, and make it apparent that both parties are destroying our freedoms as citizens. I lived in New York City for 13 years, and I was there for September 2001. I lost firefighter friends on Ladder 11 truck, all six of whom perished. After 9/11, and witnessing all the police dressed in black and their aggressive activities, I made a mental note to myself that America was heading into a seriously dark place. No surprise we are where we are today, I guess, which is so sad. Here's my question for you, which I have not heard anyone anywhere address in media or in politics. Why isn't anyone bringing to light that America is now 19th in the world for its current democracy? Knowing this fact, the only source I found was on Wikipedia under Democracy Index, where we are ranked 19th. Knowing this fact, I want to smash my TV when I hear anyone boast, especially Bush or Obama, about how great and free America is as a nation. If more people were aware of this decline, I feel it might add some motivation for others to become more involved with bringing about some change. I consider myself a liberal-minded American. I work in the arts. I see no difference anymore between either party. They're both running the same con job using a slightly altered script, which appeals to whichever party is in power at the moment, and taking away our freedoms and keeping us all arguing to weaken us as a population. You know, divide and conquer. Thanks for your consideration in addressing this fact. I enjoy listening to your program. Patrick." There's really nothing that I could say that you didn't say in your email, Patrick, really. I don't disagree. I guess because you are a new listener, you may not be aware that we've been talking about this for the better part of certainly the past 10 years and probably even longer than that. And I'll say what I've said many times. The system under which we are trying to self-govern is totally broken. I don't mean broken like a broken chair on a leg where you just repair it and sit back down. I'm talking about broken where it's irreparable. Well, this is just my opinion and a few million other people, but it's totally broken. And it's not ours anymore. It's owned by corporate America. It is owned by a handful of capitalists who the Occupy movement has identified as the 1%. It's probably where it is, an even narrower or smaller cadre than that that really controls the country. I remember when people used to talk about this 15 or 20 years ago, they were immediately labeled as kooks, conspiracy freaks. Oh, yeah, and they all meet. Where do they meet? Oh, yeah, in Bilderberg. Well, they're all in the Council of Foreign Relations. No, it's much, 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 much worse than that. Anyway, even though I was talking about shooting people when I was talking with Bob Kincaid last hour, or wondering if people can kill us, if the corporatists can kill us, the capitalists can kill us and poison every goddamn thing in America, not to mention the planet, why can't we kill them And as Kincaid pointed out, the obvious answer, you just don't do that. As Gandhi said, or somebody said, an eye for an eye, and eventually everybody's blind. So, as Chris Hedges has pointed out, as several leading radical philosophers in this country are pointing out now, Kevin Zeese, Margaret Flowers, Bob Kincaid, I agree, and there are more, massive civil disobedience. And as Kincaid mentioned, not pacifism, but to take the pacific attitude of Gandhi and couple it with the activist attitude of Martin Luther King Jr. and resist. We've talked about this on this program, that the system cannot be repaired. It simply can't. There needs to be a replacement. We have done this for 230 years. We have made modifications to the original charter of this country. We've changed some things. We've added some things. And I think through a lot of our periods of history, we've made an effort to live up to some sort of universal standard of equality under the law, justice, decency, human rights, fair play. But that isn't happening now. And I think I truly believe that our system has thoroughly poisoned massive parts of the planet to the point where this capitalist monster is everywhere. Even in communist China, you know, there it is. So, what to do about it? If you can't mend it, end it. Change it. You know, survival of the fittest doesn't mean survival of the strongest. It doesn't. It means survival is guaranteed to those organisms that best fit in to a new model. And I think it should be thought of in those terms, survival of the fittest. It doesn't mean survival of the strongest. So, given that, and given the fact that to a lot of us, this corporate power that now runs this country, this perverted, toxic, death-dealing capitalism, given that reality, what do you want to do? Do you want to do nothing? You know, what are the four boxes? Huh? What's the saying? There are four boxes for use in the defense of liberty or in the defense of the planet or in the defense of human rights. What are they? You start with the soap box, and then there's the ballot box, and then the jury box, and then the ammo box. And whoever came up with that said use them in that order. But the people I've been listening to lately, regardless of the ugliness of my rhetoric sometimes, the people I've been listening to lately don't or are not interested in that fourth box. They're interested in a different way altogether. Massive civil disobedience, massive resistance to a system that is just killing us all. I don't know how or why we can't come together on that realization. I don't get it. We'll be right back.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Paranoia strikes deep. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man calls.
Of all the sound of the street.
Frank Malloy.
21 past the hour. The number here is 877-996-2556 if you'd like to join in. And Jim is in Las Vegas listening on Sirius. Hi, Jim.
What's up, Mike? Another great show.
Oh, thanks.
Especially about the coal issue. It just kind of blows my mind that, you know, they have to be fairly well educated, these moguls and stuff. Do they just disregard the fact that eventually it's going to affect them, and if they're going to die soon, eventually their children, if they keep on just putting out this pollution and degradation all over the planet?
Well, that's, you know, that's a question that has puzzled me also. I think the answer is, I think these folks have been told that we are approaching another great extinction, or die-off, big die-off. We're 7 billion plus population now. Resources are being reduced as far as access to those resources is concerned. Clean air, clean water, arable land, blah, blah, blah. As the population increases and the ability to take care of the population declines, you have more disease, you have fewer areas on the planet that are self-sustaining where it concerns food and water and clean air and so on and so forth. So eventually, I think what the 0.1% is counting on is that there will be a massive die-off brought about by either one or a combination of war, disease, pest, you know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, that sort of thing, and that they will survive. That the 0.1% or 0.01% and 1% that have the treasure, the wherewithal, the means to lock themselves up into impenetrable little enclaves until this disaster passes. That's the only thing I can come up with, that what they're counting on is to exploit until that day when the die-off begins. I know this sounds crazy, but I can't come up with any other reason, because you're absolutely right. Do they have access to air someplace on this planet that is more breathable? Do they have access to water that is more drinkable and less toxic? Do they have access to some sort of immunity from diseases that are caused by global warming as insect carriers and vectors spread around the... You know, I have no idea, Jim. It just puzzles the hell out of me what they're thinking.
Okay, one more question.
Sure.
Where do they think they're going to get their next group of slackies to work for them if they're only left?
Well, I guess they figure they won't need it anymore, you know, with all the wealth and all the best real estate. And, I mean, if you reduce the population by 80%, you still have enough people left on the planet to be slaves. To be
those would be the lucky slaves.
Well, possibly, but I don't know how they would be lucky. They would continue to slave away. Change it from a noun to a verb. They'll continue to slave away for the 0.1%. I don't know. It's all madness, Jim. I can't. I can't. I wish I had an answer. I wish you had an. I wish you had an answer.
All right, I'll call you up next week with an answer. I'll let you go.
All right, thanks, Jim. Thank God somebody is going to come up with an answer. Got to have an answer. Just at least one answer. Huh? See, you and I, now listen up. You and I, you know, our time is so limited. I mean, most of the people that that I address on this program, that I meet with on this program, you know, we're over a certain age. I don't mean you're into decrepitude. I'm just saying probably the demographic of our audience is mostly people over the age of 40. A lot of them over the age of 50, over 60. We have that huge middle age group, 40 to 70, 75, 80. I don't know what the oldest age of our listeners are. But I don't think we have that many young people. And that's probably a good thing. They shouldn't be listening to this this crazy talk. They should be active, changing it, like Bob Kincaid is trying to do. But the point is, our time is so limited. And whether or not, well, let me rephrase it, the chances of our seeing the results of our attempts to change the system, the chances of our seeing that are fairly slim. You know that as well as I do. But you plant seeds, isn't that the idea? You know, you be the sower of seed, hoping that it is going to grow after you and I have, stepped off this mortal coil into the next round of eternity. Do you get what I'm saying? I'm sure you do. Here from Prairie 2, why people accept feudalism, which is where we're all headed in this country. Bruce writes, as long as people get their basic needs met, more or less, and they are convinced by propaganda that all failures in this regard are their own fault, they will accept their slow but inextricable march toward their place in line at the Soylent Green Factory. And from Kate, Mike, regarding the interview with Bob Kincaid, good on you. It's not often that you're rendered speechless. What Bob describes so eloquently is happening here in Montana. Polluted air, miles-long trainloads of coal heading west all the way to China, hideous pits dug into Mother Earth, polluted water, fracking all over the state, polluted water killing the cattle, tar sands extraction 200 miles north of me, causing all kinds of political, social, and health problems, especially for the First Nations people in Montana, North Dakota, and Canada. God, I'm so glad I am old. Kate. Oh. Well, no, I certainly understand that. Kate has done an enormous amount of trying to bring justice to the society also. I used to refer to her as Kate in the Desert. That's how I first, when she first started emailing me several years ago, Kate in the Desert. But she went to work down after Katrina. She spent the past winter and fall, I believe, spring, hauling veterans from towns in the big sky country to the nearest VA facilities, some of which were a 4 or 5 hour drive away, and then driving them back. She's done a lot of activist work, just like Bob Kincaid, like Jude, like a lot of people. God, I'm glad I'm old. That's a hell of a thing, right? Um. but I get it. Carl is in Nashville, Tennessee. Hello, Carl.
Hey, Mike. Hell of a discussion.
Scary. But you know, Bob Kincaid scares me. He's got too much truth. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Let me explain something. A little of my background.
Okay.
My grandfather, my mother's side, fought World War II. My grandfather, my father's side, fought in the Korean War and Vietnam, and my father fought in Vietnam.
Mm.
I'm black, and this is a country that when my grandfather came back from World War II,
mm-hmm.
treated him like a secondhand citizen.
When
my grandfather came back from Korea, treated him like a secondhand citizen. When my father came back and my grandfather came back from Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
still these men treated like secondhand citizens that fought for this country.
Right.
And where I'm coming from and where it has been embedded in my DNA as a black and a black American is to love a country that often loves to hate me.
Mm-hmm.
Black people in this country look at this country from a different perspective than white people.
Right.
And white people, and this is very well known within the black community in America, that white people have been tricked tremendously into looking at this country and thinking that if you're against capitalism, this corrupt capitalism that we have now, then you're un-American.
Right.
If you're against our American empire having the first and the second largest air force in the world, that will be the Air Force and the Navy. We have the first and the second largest air forces in the world. We haven't been in a dogfight since World War II, by the way. So if you question spending on defense, one of the brilliant things that they ever did is change it from the Department of War to the Department of Defense,
mm-hmm.
because who would want to cut defense? So all these things have been wrapped around apple pie in a good country song and all things American. And if you even question these things, you are unpatriotic, you're un-American, you don't belong in this country.
Right.
Well, what's going to need to happen?
Let me ask you something so that people would understand, I think, the perspective that you're talking about. You said white people suffer from this. How did black folk escape it? Or have you escaped it?
No, we have escaped it because, like I said, we live in a country that we love, but sometimes it loves to hate us.
Right.
So we don't. So we're not so easily wrapped up into the.
Okay.
Everything is okay because of American exceptionalism.
We understand
this is a great nation. It can be one, but we're not fooled by it because we're not invited
mm-hmm.
to that. That picture and imagery of America isn't meant for us. It's meant for lower class, middle class, white people, by upper class white Americans to keep them in line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what it's going to take, unfortunately, is black people in America, all 13, 14, 15 million of us, we can go out and march tomorrow, and not one thing is going to change. Things don't change until white middle class and lower class Americans decide that we're going to go out and we're not going to take this anymore, and then we're going to go out and take the fight to the 1%.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
To a 99% movement of middle class, the lower class, white people, until they stand up and say, hey, enough is enough, because we get ignored because we don't have, black people in this country don't have lobbyists. I mean, the political structure, the political power, unfortunately, and people won't say this because they're afraid of the truth, is not handed to us. It's not a drug problem until it started hitting suburbia.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
So it's not an educational problem until it started hitting suburbia, and this is what my fellow white Americans must take these things into their own hands, because until they realized that the 40 acres of trickle-down that they was promised 30, 40 years ago was just a joke on you, then nothing will ever change in this country, and we'll continue to have legalized slave labor in this country, working at wages that's unbearable and unsustainable for a person to
survive. Sure.
And until they stand up, until they say, you know what, enough is enough. We're not falling for the, if you're not, you know, if you're not for a person like a Mitt Romney making $250 million, why KB Toys and their employees run out of business and gone and no more, that's good. And until we realize, until white America realize that that's not inherently American, then and only then will we have change. But until then, they will continue to throw the American flag and how great this country is and apple pie and Babe Ruth, and they'll keep making you think that all of these things that you've been believing in is inherently American. Then you will continue to fall for that. If you continue to fall for that, then they will continue to do it to you.
Carl, well put. Thank you very much for calling in, all right? You take care. Thanks, Carl. Yeah, that's one thing that, out of many that Carl just said, that is so true. Until it affects white America, it's not a problem. Isn't that the truth? But the other night when I've talked about this race thing an awful lot, and about racism, and I made the statement that racism is a term, it's a unique term. In this country, you can't be African American and be racist. You can't be Native American and be racist. You can't be Asian American and be racist. You can be bigoted and prejudiced and hateful to other folk, but you can't be racist, because the dominant culture has been Caucasian, and it's the dominant culture that's written the laws regarding race. Now, it's true. Japan has an attitude, a racist attitude. China has a racist attitude. So it's not just the United States, but for heaven's sake, we ought to recognize what racism is. We'll be right back.
Its heart has been scarred.
Time just rips by when you're having fun, doesn't it? Huh? Julian Assange has taken refuge in Ecuador's embassy in London and is seeking political asylum. It's according to Ecuador's foreign minister, Ricardo Patino, said his government in Ecuador was weighing the request of political asylum in that country. Assange did this less than a week after Britain's Supreme Court rejected his bid to reopen his attempts to block extradition to Sweden, where he's wanted for questioning after two women accused him of sexual misconduct. Notice how it's no longer referred to as rape. And there's a reason it's not referred to as rape. Assange denies all the allegations. He has been fighting this in the UK for about 2 years, which has really put the kibosh on his website's work, exposing the world's nasty little secrets, right? Assange, who is Australian, had argued that, quote, the authorities in his country will not defend his minimum guarantees before any government or ignore the obligation to protect a politically persecuted citizen, end quote. You know, we have some listeners in Australia, and I got an email tonight, let me see if I can find it here, saying, you know, mentioning what is going on in Australia. Where is that? Damn it, where'd it go? One of the emails I got tonight, there's a huge mining industry in Australia that has, or is trying to buy up the newspapers in that country, the two leading newspapers in Australia. Wish I could find it, damn it. Oh well. So, it's not the point I'm trying to get to here, sorry, is that Julian Assange is correct in stating that his government, the Australian government, is not going to do anything to defend his minimum guarantees before any government or ignore the obligation to protect a politically persecuted citizen. Assange said it was impossible for him to return to Australia because it would not protect him from being extradited to, quote, a foreign country that applies the death penalty for the crime of espionage and or sedition. That's a reference to us, the United States. Assange believes that the United States has secretly indicted him for divulging American secrets and will act on the indictment if Sweden succeeds in extraditing him from Britain. So, now, the president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, has his own questions about human rights and press freedom. He has been questioned in his own country by press freedom activists for using Ecuador's criminal libel law in sympathetic courts against journalists from the country's biggest newspaper, El Universo. Now, Correa says that that newspaper represents the oligarchs seeking his ouster. So any questions about Correa, remember, he's a leftist Latin American president. The United States usually has those people executed, shot, hanged, destroyed, removed from office. Anyway, an update on Julian Assange, if you didn't already know. From John, as always, listening to your show is sad, enlightening, and reinforcing all at once. Here's a theory I've been kicking around in my head for a while. The laziness and apathy of the modern American citizen are a product of our 30 or 40 years of material excess that made us forget principles and embrace only wealth and frivolity. Today's young liberal reads the Huffington Post and watches The Daily Show because it's fashionable, light, and funny. They watch on iPads and flat-screen TVs without critically examining the system of environmental and human exploitation, which brings them their gizmos, gizmos that are paid for with the same dollars that corporations like Apple use to further the capitalist agenda. Liberalism, which I put in quotes because it's not really anything anymore, has been commodified, made fashionable, and neutered. There's no actual agenda of life to counter the conservative death agenda anymore. What kills me about this process is that the same older people and conservatives who decry the laziness and materialistic shallowness of today's youth are those who enrich themselves gloriously at the altar of the Reagan Revolution. Business, profits, growth! These are not just confirmations of a people's righteousness. They are systems that affect the population they serve. Our systems have corrupted us, robbed us of a visceral connection to what is going on around us. For what it's worth, I do hold a grain of optimism because, as Howard Zinn points out, this country has always been run by the rich. Today's naked power grabs may not yet go unchallenged, but I'm afraid, as you are, that the creeping corrupter of materialism, wealth, and religious know-nothingness may have reached the tipping point. John. Thanks, John. Thank you for tuning in. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.